This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If September 11th, 2001 was a wake-up call, clearly America has fallen back asleep, writes my guest Stephen Flynn. In his new book, America the Vulnerable, he warns that we appear to be unwilling to do what must be done to make our society less of a target. Flynn was the lead author of a 2002 report on Homeland Security released by a bipartisan task force chaired by former Senators Gary Hart and Warren Rudman. Flynn is currently a senior fellow in national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He worked in the White House military office during the Bush administration and worked with Richard Clark on the National Security Council in the Clinton White House. He also spent 20 years as a commissioned officer in the U.S. Coast Guard. Earlier this month, the Director of Homeland Security, Tom Ridge, warned Americans that al-Qaeda is planning an attack in an effort to disrupt the elections. I asked Stephen Flynn if he thinks this kind of warning is helpful to Americans.
One of my concerns is that we've got ourselves into a rather paternalistic approach to dealing with this new threat environment where the federal government basically says, we're going to continue to try to do our job of securing you by defeating terrorism overseas and taking some measures here at home. We can't tell you much about them because we don't want the bad guys to know what we're up to. And your job, citizens, is to essentially shop and travel. To trust us. I think this is an inherently flawed paradigm. We, the people, are the most likely targets. Our day-to-day, the underpinnings of our society are the most likely targets, and we need to be brought into the conversation about what the risks are, what the threat is, and most importantly, about how we design solutions to deal with these problems, to manage the risk that these threats pose.
In the bipartisan task force report on Homeland Security that you were the lead author of in 2002, you concluded, America remains dangerously unprepared to prevent and respond to catastrophic terrorist attacks on U.S. soil. Do you think Homeland Security has gotten any better since you wrote that in 2002?
Not much. On a scale of 1 to 10, if I put it in that range where 1 is a bullseye, we're a bullseye, and 10 is we're secure, we're certainly a 1 on 9/11. You know, today we're maybe at a 3. I assign this a failing grade precisely because while there has been some progress making some efforts of addressing some of our most glaring vulnerabilities and our very limited capacity as a government to deal with these threats, they've really been on the margins, and that stands in marked contrast to the investment we've been willing to make and the sacrifice, even in life, to deal with terrorism as an overseas problem. We've got a situation where the national security establishment essentially focuses on water's edge out, and that was an outgrowth of the fact that we had almost two centuries of living in the most peaceful corner of the planet. We had friendly neighbors to the north and to the south, big oceans to the east and west, and there were no enemy boots on our ground in the 20th century. And so we dealt with security as something that we handled overseas, bases on our soils of our allies or in actual combat with adversaries on their soil. And that didn't change on 9/11. What we did is we essentially said, oh, we need something new to deal with the fact that there's vulnerabilities here at home. Let's create something different than national security. We'll call it homeland security. But all the eggs remain heavily in the national security basket. For instance, there are 361 commercial seaports in this country, and the CIA has said that the most likely way in which a weapon of mass destruction would come to the United States is by sea. And the United States has spent close to $500 million on grants in 3 years to help those seaports get more secure, which may sound a lot of money to many Americans. That's what we're spending every 3 days in Iraq. Basically, we're spending every 3 days in the war on terror in Iraq, what we spent in three years on dealing with one of our most serious vulnerabilities.
Do you think that the war in Iraq is using up money that should have been spent on homeland security? Is the war in Iraq, I don't know if you see this as a zero-sum game or not, but is the war in Iraq taking money away from homeland security, or do you see it as like helping the efforts even though it's money being spent in another country?
We're a very wealthy country, and we have a sort of second-to-none military, and we can afford both an offense and a defense. My focus has been primarily on the defense side of it, and my concern that there's been so little effort made to make us less attractive as a target. So, well, you know, when we're faced with a situation as we are now, where our enemies have to be creative if they're going to challenge U.S. power, and they're most likely to do that by not confronting our military directly, then we have to begin to think about, okay, why do they think they can get such a big bang for their buck by using the tactic of catastrophic terrorism? They will get that as long as the opportunity is rich to succeed and there's cascading effects that come from doing that. Therefore, by making ourselves more resilient as a society, taking the things that are most valuable to us and protecting it, we get actually both a tactical and a strategic advantage. The tactical one is that the harder you make it, something to strike with, the more of an effort the bad guys have to make, a terrorist would have to make, to essentially try to compromise it. They'd need more money. They need more expertise. They'd have to take more time in the planning of the cycle of it. They'd have to rehearse. All that gives you a leg up on intelligence. They're giving off some smoke signal that would ideally help you trip them up. But the other is they're doing this with the expectation that they can get a big bang for their buck. And if in fact they target things and they end up killing people and hurting a bit of property, but there's no ripple effect across the society, then they haven't in fact had a very successful tool of warfare. And so it's not a defeatist position I'm trying to maintain by trying to deal with this core reality of our vulnerability. There is in fact a military value to having a good defense.
What are some of the places that you think we're most vulnerable?
One of the areas that I have focused on that is a great vulnerability remains this container. These are the 8 foot by 8 foot by 40 foot boxes that fit on our trains and trucks and ships. They're basically the assembly lines, and they are the back shelves of our retailing manufacturing sector. That is, you know, Walmart doesn't have a back room. And most factories don't have much in the way of storeroom. It's in the transportation system. So the threat scenario is that there's a tremendous opportunity given the sheer numbers of these. It's somewhere between 16 and 18 million containers. And that right away should set off some alarms. We don't know how many containers there really are in the world right now, plus or minus a couple of million, never mind what's in them. Each one could hold up to 32 tons of material. That is loaded virtually anywhere in the planet. Somebody puts a 50-cent seal on it, on the door, and it's off to the races. Everybody in the logistics transportation business is to get it out of their hands and into somebody else's hands as quickly as possible. A container that originates in Asia, arrives in the United States, may have 17 waypoints, stop points, where it's handled by one set of players and handed off to somebody else. That's a system that has ripe in terms of opportunity for somebody to put something bad in, potentially a weapon of mass destruction. But the real danger comes from when that explosion goes off. And I talk about how this could happen in an Al-Qaeda-style scenario here in the U.S. with three or four of these going off simultaneously. It creates a sudden concern about all containers. And so the reaction, the political pressure becomes, turn it all off until we can sort this out. If we shut down our ports for a period of 2 to 3 weeks and closed our borders to sort this stuff out, and believe me, it would take a long time to try to do it from scratch, we're talking about shutting the global trade system. And it's not because the terrorists did that. We did that to ourselves because that was the only tool in the tool bag to deal with the risk.
Why don't you describe what a container is? Because it's not just like a little cardboard box. Describe what a typical shipping container is and what it would take for an actual inspector to, you know, to inspect the container.
A typical container would be the kind of thing that you would see probably if you moved your house. I mean, it's the kind of thing that fits in the back of an 18-wheeler. If you took all your household goods and you put them inside a truck, that truck is the average size of most containers that are out there. They come in the 20-foot size and the 40-foot size. And they are 8 feet by 8 feet in terms of width and height. A ship coming into the bigger ships that come into our largest port like Los Angeles and Long Beach can be carrying up to 3,000 of these 40-foot by 8-foot by 8-foot boxes that can hold up to 30 tons of material each on a single ship, offloaded in a period of about 12 to potentially 36 hours. That's what we're talking in terms of volume moving through through the system. They're the things you see on a rail car. They're the things that you see on trucks. They're so all around us, we hardly pay any attention to them.
So in other words, we're X-raying my baggage at the airport, but we're not X-raying these huge containers.
Yeah, there is, in fact, new technologies out there that will allow us to scan the contents of a container, but we don't have much of it. And there was none in any seaport prior to 9/11 but one that was looking for actually stolen cars leaving Southern Florida. We were monitoring the border with Mexico to some extent. This is where we first deployed this equipment, looking for illegal immigrants coming through in some drug shipments. But the there has been some buying of these equipment, but we basically use them for only on somewhere in the order of about 2 to 3% of all the containers that arrive in the U.S. may run through some of the scanning equipment. And in some ports, they still don't have working equipment, so that's more a physical check. And to give you an idea about the time it takes on the physical side, the rule of thumb in the business is about 5 hours with three people.
For one container.
For one container. Imagine, moving your house, right? You fill up a whole container, go in there and empty it and check it out. We're talking a lot of space and a lot of stuff potentially, and it's a physically demanding exercise. So that's where these technologies can be applied. One very interesting pilot I've been involved with, for instance, is out in the port of Hong Kong. Hong Kong is the world's busiest container terminal, container port. It moved about 19 million containers last year through this one port. And out there, they're beginning experiment where they're going to scan every container coming into a very busy, one of the busiest terminals in the world. It's one that goes 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The scan image can be done in about 10 to 15 seconds. And it's just put as the trucks queue up or, line up to get into the gate. The technology is there. We could deploy that kind of scanning technology in all the world's major ports for about $500 million, and we could clean up probably the rest of them pretty quickly as well for another $300 or so. If that, again, sounds like a lot of money, we will spend $600 million buying 4 F-22 fighters for the Air Force this upcoming year. So we are certainly talking about different scale of thinking when we're talking about making these investments.
So what do you think is holding us back from making this investment for scanning equipment for the ports? Is it a lack of money? Is it differing priorities?
Well, part of the issue is the scanning is only one piece of it. I mean, one of the challenges that we have with, and this is a case I try to make in the book, that any single point security solution always travels, we call it the path of diminishing returns. That is, it gets more and more expensive for less and less security. And inevitably, it always creates this balloon effect or this push effect that basically the bad guys know what you're doing, so they move somewhere else. The notion I've been trying to advance overall is this idea of layered security that takes advantage of LR probabilities, which is that if I have 5 60% solutions layered together, I get a 99% interception rate. This works as if I had a 60% chance to bobbing at an apple to bite it, and I get 5 shots at it, I will get it 99% of the time. And so we don't need to have perfect solutions for everything, but you need to have a number of them in a layered way. So in the case of this problem, I want some process that you have what I call a birth certificate. Somewhere at the origin point, you can feel comfortable about what was put in here was legitimate and authorized. That's a 60% solution potentially because people could be corrupted. Then I want to track the container and its integrity by putting a device inside, a GPS and other kinds of things that would track it to its port. Then I want to scan it, and then I want to track the ship, and then I want to spot check it on the arrival port. Those would be 5 layers. Any one of those layers could potentially compromise, but all together, they basically create a pretty powerful deterrent in terms of a system and give you lots of chances, lots of bites at the apple to intercept things. Now, that has cost. The cost of putting the technology into the boxes, for instance, we probably, and plus the scanning and so forth, certificate, we probably talking about $50 per load, per shipment. But today, we're spending about $3,000 to ship a shipment of up to 30 tons from Asia to the West Coast. The transportation costs are really very cheap compared to the need for an efficient and reliable system that allows us to put our assembly lines and put our inventory into the transportation system. That's the higher good, and paying some prophylactic costs, some protective measures up front to deal with that seems to me the very smart way to go. This is just one sector. There's a whole series of infrastructures, networks that we have that have similar attributes, but we need to be thinking in those kinds of ways. So part of the problem is just people have not been willing to step back and think out the problem in a systemic way. If all want these sort of silver bullet, one-shot approaches, which don't work, whether it's technology or whatever, and not willing to think a little more imaginatively about how we make this thing hum.
How do you think the funding of Homeland Security should be divided between the federal government, state governments, and city governments? For example, New York's Mayor Bloomberg said recently, we're not getting our fair share of Homeland Security money. And he's furious because New York is such a high-risk target. And he feels that the federal government isn't doing enough to help New York protect itself. So I'm wondering, like, what you think that division of financial responsibility should be?
Well, first of all, I think many Americans would be surprised to know that the official strategy of the U.S. government in the form of the president's Homeland Security strategy says pretty explicitly the job that it's to do is national defense and border security, and the job of Homeland Security is primarily a job for the private sector and state and local governments. That's a division of labor they carved out without any real debate with the rest of us here, but that's pretty much where it is. Obviously, states and locals, particularly since 2001, don't have a lot of resources to make the kinds of investments that need to be made in the short term, and they can't run large deficits like the federal government does. The private sector is always worried about the bottom line, and it's not just simply they have their heads in the sand. If a company's CEO tried to do the right thing in his own sector with his own property to prop things up, and his neighbors to the left and right don't, then the bad guy's going to go to the weak point, but the whole sector's going to be affected. So we need common standards. They have to be uniformly enforced. The debate is about how we arrive at them and how we get there. So that is takes some government role. That takes some regulatory role. And it also takes that the engagement of citizens and private sector. And again, when we compare it to a cost of $500 billion the United States will spend this year on traditional national security, and about 5 to 7 cents on that dollar for what it will pay total on Homeland Security, it doesn't seem to me that we have much in the way of balance between the war on terror over there versus the war on terror on the home front.
There are mayors and governors who have been complaining that members of the police force, of the fire department, of people who would be fighting wildfires are in the reserves, and they're in Iraq. And therefore, there are shortages of the number of people on the forces, and these are first responders in many instances. So, in that sense, we're becoming understaffed in the war on terrorism on the home front.
That's clearly the case. Many of the people who end up in the National Guard are people who are part-time policemen, or part-time sheriffs, part-time prison guards, or firefighters, and so forth. So, when they're called off to do the duty overseas, the cities and states are losing some of their critical experts and resources to deal with the threat if it plays itself out here at home. Now, that may have had a short-term necessity if we thought there was a clear and present threat overseas to deal with, but to the extent we're looking at a very long-term engagement of the Guard and the Reserves as a part of dealing with a long presence in Iraq, it only raises our vulnerability up greater that we don't have this expertise professionals. You just can't create them overnight. These are people who live and are part of our communities here at home. So the exposure is quite high, and it's something that I very much worry about. You know, 9/11 happened here, and you know, it's a bit of a disconnect. On the one hand, we're told that the best defense is a good offense. We need to go over there so we don't have to deal with the enemy over here. And then you have the Secretary of Homeland Security, Tom Ridge, stand up in front of the American people in early July and say they're here and they're likely to strike in the next few months. We have to confront the reality of 9/11. We're an open, hugely vulnerable society.
Now, you used to be in the Coast Guard. You spent, I think, 20 years in the Coast Guard, and you explain in your book the Coast Guard is charged with protecting 95,000 miles of shoreline, and the force in the Coast Guard is about the same size as the New York Police Department. And that sounds like a pretty impossible task. What are some of the things you learned about the difficulties of Homeland Security by being in the Coast Guard?
I had a 20-year career as an active duty officer in the Coast Guard and also was a graduate of the Coast Guard Academy. So I took this oath to protect and defend our nation at age 17 and went off and did it and retired just 2 years ago. One of the things I learned was a little sort of quirky thing, that our Defense Department didn't protect the nation or even its borders. That was something that agencies like the Coast Guard. But then when you look at who these agencies are, like the Coast Guard, who are charged with this, the Coast Guard is operating one of the oldest fleets in the world. It's both aviation and its ships, but its ships go back to some of them commissioned in the 1940s. The Coast Guard has been getting more money because it's a critical part of the Homeland Security Department than it did before 9/11, but it's more money to replace these decades-old ships in the next 25 years. That's when I sort of get at this point of not dealing with this level of urgency.
Do you think Homeland Security has been used as a political football in Congress? In other words, do you think politics are getting in the way of security?
There is no question that politics have gotten in the way of our taking on homeland security, and both sides are to blame. This is not a Democratic issue. It's not a Republican issue. It's an American issue. It's probably the most issue for our upcoming election. And my fear is that it may not even get much talked about. We'll talk about the war on terrorism as something overseas and how it could be fought differently. But we won't talk about, there's the core reality of 9/11, our own vulnerability. And I hope that the American people will press both these candidates into saying, what are you doing? What's your plan? What's your plan for dealing with this?
Well, Stephen Flynn, thank you so much for talking with us.
I thank you for very much having the chance to do so.
Stephen Flynn is the author of the new book, America the Vulnerable. He's a senior fellow in National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.